I'm Jason Michael Perry, the man with three first names, and this is Thoughts on Tech and Things. Today, we're talking space and how it's becoming an incredibly competitive space. It's also becoming a thing that has more material impact on regular folks as rocket launch costs fall, making it a serious economic battleground. To talk about what's real, what's coming next, and how businesses are actually building right now in space and orbit, I'm joined by Andrew Parlock, founder and CEO of Space Phoenix Systems. But first, let's look at some of the headlines that frame this moment. According to Bloomberg, SpaceX is setting up a deal that values the company at something like $800 billion, making it the largest privately held company in the world, surpassing OpenAI, which is valued at somewhere around $500 billion. This new valuation potentially sets the stage for a future IPO that could turn SpaceX into one of the largest companies by market cap on the planet. And when you start talking numbers like that, it becomes pretty clear that space isn't just some fad. As SpaceX is continuing to build out its Starlink satellite system and also make rocket launches cheaper, CNBC is reporting that an NVIDIA-backed startup trained an AI model in space. And that sounds wild, but it's laying the groundwork for orbital data centers. You heard that right. Orbital data centers that wouldn't face the same zoning rights or community pushback that we're seeing in Maryland or here on Earth. And it's not just SpaceX. Jeff Bezos and Blue Origin have been quietly talking about this and even predicting that gigawatt-scale data centers in space will happen in the next 10 to 20 years, powered by continuously available solar energy as they orbit Earth. Like always, links on all of these stories are in the show notes, and it's obvious to see that when you bring all this stuff together, well, space is heating up. And that's exactly what I want to talk with Andrew about, so let's get into it. For many of us, space feels impossible, something you only see in movies, TV shows, or books, because it's so hard to grasp as part of our daily life that it feels just distant and abstract. But here's the thing. Space is no longer just imagination. It's already embedded in our daily lives. It's something that we don't always notice, but it's still part of the next phase of how things are going to happen, and it's undeniable. Space is more than NASA or exploratory missions. Today, it's a growing economy that includes manufacturing, tourism, communication. It's emerging as launch costs continue to drop. And this is a new frontier that's becoming a battleground for today's businesses. It's not just fantasy. And that's the future I wanted to explore today. To do that, I'm joined with Andrew Parlock, founder and CEO of Space Phoenix Systems. Andrew is a veteran in the space industry with leadership roles across commercial, civil, and national security missions. Space Phoenix focuses on space logistics and returnable payloads, something I'm hoping you can explain a bit about in a minute, with an eye towards enabling real economic activity in space and low Earth orbit, something that we'll make sure that we explain. Andrew, welcome.
Thanks so much, Jason. Glad to be here.
So I used a few words that I would love if you could explain, and maybe the easiest place to start is, can you tell us what Space Phoenix does and what are these payloads or returnable payloads that you guys work with?
Yeah, really interesting. You mentioned space logistics, and that already probably throws some of the listeners off. Space Phoenix exists to help companies, researchers, university partners, government partners, get payloads, get stuff up into space, complete a mission, and then most importantly, get it back. For pretty much the entire history of space, other than human spaceflight, space has been a one-way trip, right? We send communication satellites up to be, you know, comms, bent pipe comms in space, or GPS satellites up there to ping our locations on Earth. But it's a data play, right? You send a satellite up, you never see it again. But we're entering this new world of in-space manufacturing. We're taking advantage of a microgravity environment and this hyper-clean environment of space. And there's a lot of people out there doing a lot of really cool stuff. And Space Phoenix realized about 4 years ago, when I came up with the concept of Space Phoenix, about 4 years ago, we realized there's a lot of people that are trying to get stuff up, complete a mission, and then get that stuff back to the marketplace, right? They're making stuff in space. So Space Phoenix is there to solve that problem, to help folks get up to space and get back. Simplest analogy, we're the FedEx box truck for space.
So if I were to picture this, Maybe I have a mini manufacturing system that I create, and I shoot this thing up into space, and in zero gravity, there are benefits, which I'm sure we'll get a chance to talk about, that allows it to do its thing. And then once it completes its task, once it does whatever task operations or work, it may be manufacturing a drug or a product, it drops down to Earth and you pick it up and deliver it right at my doorstep.
It sounds so simple. I mean, more or less, right? Like, you know, we're what we call free flyers, right? So I'm a total space nerd, so I'm just going to try to, you know, free flyers, we're a free flying satellite, right? We don't attach to a space station or another vehicle in space. So we go up on a SpaceX rocket. You know, that's the one that everyone knows. But there's about 30 other companies globally, launch companies. We'll go up on any number of rockets into space, be released, right, with the customer payloads inside. And we'll have multiple customer payloads on any number of spacecraft. And then those, and you're exactly right, those payloads, that what we call them, are these self-contained processes. Maybe they're making a new semiconductor material, a new biotech. They're doing cancer research. Amazing work. There's a company right here in Baltimore, Melitech, doing super, super cool stuff in space. The one guy, Ramirez, he's known as the space mushroom guy. Really, really cool stuff that you can do in space, but you have to be able to get it up into space, manage the mission, and then return it to Earth. And it's getting back is sometimes just as hard as is getting up.
Now, I want to come back to manufacturing, but you mentioned all of these companies that are involved in space and this evolving thing that is the space economy. And I find it fascinating because I think most people feel disconnected for the impact that the space economy and this technology has on their daily lives. And just as an example, I was reading something earlier today that the Space Force spends $2 million a day maintaining the satellites that are needed for GPS. And I don't know if most people realize that these are, you know, what, a series of satellites that are providing this geopositioning. I mean, it's kind of in the name, GPS, the S is the satellite. But this is just one example of the importance that space plays in our everyday life. You know, are there other things that you can give us as just examples of like how the space economy is playing a role for you and I?
Yeah, I'll give you what's happening today. I'll give you kind of what's happening tomorrow, and then I'll give you what we call the art of the achievable. And that's a big part of Space Phoenix's premise. So yeah, I mean, GPS is the one that, heck, I connected to a GPS satellite just getting here and I'm a mile away. Right, but it pinged my position. You lay it over some Google Maps, and boom, you're there. And people don't even realize that data's coming from space. You know, the most obvious things: communication satellites. They sit up in a geostationary orbit. So that's an orbit right around the equator, where the satellites rotate at the same speed that the Earth is revolving. So they're geostationary. They're high enough above the planet that they just stay right over the same spot, which is perfect for communications, satellite radio, XM radio. We hear about this all the time. We're pinging satellites and getting music. That's pretty cool. But this is the weird part about it. Space has been a data play. Weather, crop data, tracking wildfires, tracking ships at sea. It's a data play, right? These satellites go up and they beam data back, right? They observe the Earth, they observe crop formations, ice formations in the Arctic, ships that may or may not supposed to be there, lots and lots of government uses for understanding where troops are and, you know, battle readiness and other, you know, quote unquote, spy satellites. That was the world I lived in for a long time. You know, so a data play. So now, you know, what's happening tomorrow? Tomorrow, we're starting to bring stuff back. The ISS opened up an incredible new world. I mean, the ISS has been up there since 1998. Just incredible. And we've multiple missions up there. We were using the Russian Soyuz and now the SpaceX Dragon. So we're starting to see this two-way trip. And we were doing a lot of fundamental research and then applied research, right? Creating semiconductor materials that are 10x more efficient, produce 50% less heat.
So we could just pause there for a second. So the ISS, the International Space Station, which sadly, it's coming down relatively soon in a few years.
Yeah, 3 years.
But what you just mentioned is that the ability to do research and experiment gave us this opportunity to learn about microgravities in zero-G manufacturing and a lot of things that we can't do easily on Earth.
Yeah.
Right?
So you mentioned science fiction before. Here's the realm of science fiction, anti-gravity chamber. You can't get away from gravity. Gravity is related to mass. The Earth has mass, therefore you're never going to get rid of gravity, right? So you get up into the microgravity environment of space, and really what's happening, you get rid of the air resistance, right? There's, you know, very little atmosphere, and you're basically falling around the Earth at the same speed that you're traveling around the Earth. So you're in orbit. That's the physics behind it, right? And that gives you, it's like a little kid spinning a ball on a string, right? You're just balancing right there. So you get into this microgravity environment and a lot of things happen. You get rid of what's called convection, right? I'm getting a little technical here, but you get rid of how things mix. The impossibilities of things mixing on Earth become real probabilities and real applications in space. So different chemical regions, different physical regions, they mix together and they connect in a way in space that they never could on Earth. I'll give you an example without getting too technical. There's some semiconductor materials that on Earth, when you try to produce this, the best processes, 5% or less yield. So for every 10 pounds of material you try to create, you're getting ounces, okay? In space, it's 95%.
Wow.
Right?
Wow.
So the economy's there, right? Same thing with biotechs. We go back to our sophomore year in high school or junior year in high school, the ideal gas equation. Mm-hmm. Well, the ideal gas equation's only ideal in ideal conditions. You got to get rid of gravity, got to get rid of air, got to get rid of oxygen, nitrogen, got to get rid of all these things that we as humans love, but biotechs and advanced materials don't, right? They're contaminants. So it's this hyper-clean, gravity-free or microgravity environment that opens up a fantastic realm of possibilities for manufacturing.
Now, where you produce this also depends on the distance that you are from the Earth, right? There are these different bands. You're saying microgravity, but does it matter that as they get further from Earth, does that make a difference?
Okay, sure. In the gravitational force equation, distance does come into play, but it's less of a factor. What's happening here is you mentioned it before, LEO, low Earth orbit. That's really where most of this stuff's done, and the reason it's done there is it's the easiest orbit to get to, right? You only have to go 17,500 miles per hour to get there. It's pretty close, right? We're actually closer to LEO orbit than we are to New York City right now. People don't realize just how close space is. So LEO's the easy one, right? That's where SpaceX, quote-unquote, drops you off. That's where pretty much everyone drops you off. Firefly, Relativity, Baltimore's own Rocket Labs.
So we think of the satellites from SpaceX, that power there, that's all in low Earth orbit.
That's all in low Earth orbit. So it's becoming crowded, right? Now, low Earth orbit is anywhere from about 160 kilometers up to about 1,200 kilometers. So it's a pretty big area, right? And, you know, things are moving around. But there's a lot of stuff up there. And there's a lot of stuff that we don't want up there, right? There's a lot of, you know, they talk about space junk. But it's still really a pristine environment for manufacturing.
You mentioned Dragon and a few of these different rockets. Mm-hmm. And I would say that a big, you know, push to the space economy, one of the things that has made it so easy, or easier is probably the better way to say it, to get, you know, satellites or things up into space, is that the cost has dropped tremendously. So I looked at some numbers. About 50 years ago, 1975, to get a 1 kilogram payload was like $100,000.
Easy.
You know, and then in 20 years ago, 2005, you know, that same 1 kilogram was $55,000. And now, when I look at pricing and estimates, it's about $1,500 per kilogram. You know, something around there, $1,500 to $2,000, which is just drastically cheaper. And I know reusable space rockets, you know, are part of this, but that opens up the opportunity to experiment and explore things like manufacturing in a way that it was just cost prohibitive. It felt like a thing that was impossible, right? But it changes this from sci-fi and fantasy to, you know, for $1,500, for $3,000, you can purchase a small satellite. They're called CubeSats or small satellites, and you can put on a phone and a camera and all these different things, and you can launch that thing into space, and you can have your own communication satellite that you can talk with. And that's, I think it's just crazy to realize that that's a thing that's possible and a somewhat low-cost thing that you can do today. It's crazy to me.
Yeah, so let's stick with fantasy for a while.
Okay. I like fantasy.
Yeah, there's a thing called the Rumpelstiltskin paradox. We actually just wrote an article called RIP Rumpelstiltskin. We'll get that in a second. Rumpelstiltskin paradox came up in the 80s, and it was this. If you took the shuttle bay, right? Everyone remembers Rumpelstiltskin. He was this guy who lived in the mountains, and he could spin straw into gold, right? Amazing. So the Rumpelstiltskin paradox is this. If you filled the shuttle bay with straw on Earth, brought it into space, weaved it somehow, turned it somehow into gold, and brought it back to Earth, you would still lose money. Okay? Same thing with the International Space Station. International Space Station, incredibly expensive, incredibly important, but incredibly expensive. We're getting to the point now where we're going to be able, right? And this sounds crazy because we're so used to, a lot of people listening are business people. They work for businesses. And we know that if you make product A, you have to sell it for price B, and B has to be more than it costs to make the product, right? Otherwise, you don't have profit. Well, the Rumpelstiltskin paradox has always said that you can't do that in space. Space Phoenix and companies like us, we're going to be, for the first time ever, disrupting the Rumpelstiltskin paradox. We're going to be creating things in space that can be brought back to Earth and sold, seems so crazy, but sold for more than the total cost, right? Including rockets and so on and so forth. There's another interesting part of what you said. Jeff Bezos was asked a couple months back by Brian Cox. He was getting interviewed, and Brian Cox asked him, what made, Amazon, the original Amazon, like so successful? And he said, it was the internet and the postal service. If I had to worry about delivering my books or developing the internet, I never would have been successful. If you ask me 5 years from now what's made Space Phoenix so successful, it's just what you said. The lowering of launch cost, right? And 30 global providers for launch. Otherwise, if I had to build my own rocket and then do all this up, it would never happen. Right? You would continue with this paradox of not being able to be profitable in space.
So who's your ideal customer? When I think of this, and maybe this is the just that it's hard to conceive that there's something that is potentially affordable that a business like mine could decide that, hey, I'm going to manufacture a product in space and build a thing and launch into space, have this thing, manufacture items, using whatever automated processes, and then deliver it back to Earth and sell it. And I wonder if there's a lot of educating that you have to do just to help businesses understand that there is a possibility that they can create something that maybe seemed impossible at one point that now is more possible than they realize.
Yeah, wow, boy. What always happens with these questions about space? They're always bigger than you even think. So there's three parts to your question. The first is who's the ideal customer, right? The ideal customer right now is folks that are at the bleeding edge of semiconductor material processing, biotechs, at the bleeding edge of biotech. As an example, we just had a big press release last week with United Semiconductors. United Semiconductors is making a particular material. It's that material that it's 2-4% yields on Earth, but in space we can do 95-98% yields, like near perfect creation in space. A kilogram of this material comes back to Earth, double-digit millions of dollars. It's insane, right? Wow. We still got to get them up there and get it back cheaply, and there's a lot of risk to it, right? But we can do it, right? There's a biotech company. I just think they're amazing. They're called Lamb Division. Nicole Wagner is their CEO. She's just an amazing woman. They are 3D printing protein retinas. They're 3D printing retinas in space. Gravity will not allow you to do this on Earth. You cannot do it on Earth. They're 3D printing retina in space, bringing them back to Earth, and literally curing blindness. this is insane. Like, this is the art of the achievable. It's, you can do this. So these are our ideal customers, customers that are trying to solve really, really hard and tractable problems, right? So that's the one part of your question. Then the next part of your question is, you know, that's like an ideal customer. And well, and what kind of company comes? I want to take the burden off the companies. I want to say to a company, hey, listen, we can produce semiconductor materials that are 50% more, produce 50% less heat and are 10x more efficient. Is that something that's attractive to you, Mr. Mrs. Semiconductor Manufacturer? Yes, it is. Okay, great. Don't worry about where it's manufactured. We'll manage the manufacturing piece of it, right? So let's just get it to the market. Let's get it into the supply chain. So I want to take that burden off of the companies that are thinking there. I just don't want, I want them to think about what's the next evolution of their product, and then next evolution of their product may come from space. The next evolution of photovoltaic, it comes from space. The next evolution of battery power, it comes from space. These are things that are happening now.
This sounds amazing, but a lot of people who I talk to, especially when I start going on to all the amazing things in space, the next thing is, well, we have to fix the problems on Earth first.
Yes,
there's climate change. There's so many things that are problems, right? And how do we invest so much into building this space economy and putting the money there as opposed to putting money towards the problems that we have right here in our terrestrial Earth?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a great quote. It's attributed to Albert Einstein, whether it was or not, I don't know. The problems that were created by today's technology will not be solved by today's technology, right? Climate change was created with this carbon-focused economy, right? We got to get away from that, right? Think about what's happening with data centers right now. The amount of power we're putting into data centers. They're reopening Three Mile Island. we're creating these data centers. And what's the, Jason, you're a computer nerd. You know, it's heat. Heat's the big problem, right? If we can produce semiconductors that produce 50% less heat, we're solving a problem here on Earth. If we can develop therapeutics in orbit that can cure cancer, we're solving problems on Earth. The prospect of a pure carbon nanotube battery is like nirvana in the battery world. The carbon nanotubes that we can create in space will take battery technology to the next level. The photovoltaics that we can create in space will take solar energy to the next level. So by utilizing tomorrow's technology, we can solve some of these problems here today. One last thing, and this is a little bit of a mind blow. Now, the numbers, you know, you have to ignore some of the rocket piece, but, you know, but even putting it all together, in-space manufacturing is inherently carbon negative. We're pulling carbon industries off Earth into space, right? As we get more mature and we get more infrastructure in space, there'll be less of this up and down, right? So, man, the prospect of what we're doing here is to solve the problems on Earth.
There's a TV show that I'm a huge fan of. It's called For All Mankind. It airs on Apple TV, and it's a pretty realistic telling of space and space travel. And without giving away too much, there's a season that talks about this possibility of mining asteroids and mining comets and also faraway places for rare earth minerals and also opening the doors for things that, you know, that we can't produce here on Earth. Mm-hmm. Earth. But there was a quote, I hopefully you can remember it and you say it the perfect way that I think just really embodies like the carbon, you know, statement, like how important Earth is. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Keep going.
So when we talked last time about rare earth minerals, mm-hmm. The thing that you reminded me is that there is we focus on this idea of things that are in space that you can't find, but what's here on Earth that is rare that we can't find anywhere else.
That's right.
And those are trees. Those are carbon life, you know, life forms that we can't figure out where else they are anywhere in the galaxy. But trees only exist here. But these minerals and metals and other things that may be rare here on planet Earth that we can find in abundance on maybe Mars or the moon or on asteroids, like these things are actually in abundance in space. And sometimes when we get this kind of a little bit confused when we think about this idea of what's rare and what's not rare.
Yeah, there was just funny enough, Jason, there was an article that just came out Tuesday. They have an asteroid, a near-Earth asteroid, that has 700 quadrillion, I didn't even know it was a word, dollars worth of gold.
Wow.
On the asteroid. There's asteroids out there that have lithium, cobalt, all these quote-unquote rare earth minerals in abundance, right? The moon, H3, helium-3. This has become really something that can, if the prospect of H3 is real, this really solves energy production. This is the ultimate clean energy. But it's on the moon, right? So, and all this lithium and cobalt are on these near-Earth asteroids. Like, what do you do? Well, we've got to create vehicles. We've got to create lunar return vehicles that can get this stuff at least into low Earth orbit to be produced to create products that we can send back down to Earth, or maybe back down to Earth to create products, you know, here terrestrially. We've got to get there. Yeah, and that was actually my quote. You know, I always say wood is so we only know one planet in the known universe that can produce wood. It's Earth. But we know that there's asteroids out there with hundreds of thousands of quadrillion dollars worth of minerals. We just got to get to them.
And that next step of, which I think is the question of what do we do after ISS, mm-hmm. the International Space Station, and is this a commercial thing that gets launched up? But that feels like that's part of this lunar, you know, problem, having something that is in place between Earth and between the moon and ultimately Mars, of course, vehicles that can refuel gas stations in space, mm-hmm. to help alleviate the problem, you know, in this next lunar project, which is potentially a landing on the moon, being able to also pick, you know, have a rocket that shoots back up from the moon and comes back and lands on Earth. You know, these seem like the next progression, but also if we can start to do this as cheap as we can launch rockets from Earth, it opens up all types of possibilities, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So the ISS comes down in 2030. That's set in stone.
Yeah.
And I think SpaceX is going to be doing the majority of that deorbiting. And that's going to be messy. I'm not going to lie to you. That's a tough mission. The people don't realize just how big the ISS is. And a lot of metal up there, and we've got to dispose of it. And boy, kind of horrible, right? We're just going to burn this stuff up in the atmosphere
and just burn up as it comes down.
Yeah, and drop it up in the oceans. It's not a great way to do it. But that's what we have right now. That's what we're dealing with. So there's a couple companies, Axiom, Gravitix, Star Lab is a collaboration between Mitsubishi, European Space Agency, a couple other companies, Voyager Space. They're coming together to produce, it's a really bad acronym, it's called CLD, Commercial LEO Destination, commercial space stations. Commercial space stations are the answer, right? They're the ones that are going to give us that permanence of humans in space. But that's just part of the problem, man. And now we need unmanned space stations. We need unmanned platforms where we can do real production. We don't even want humans near some of the stuff we're producing, right? We don't want the humans involved. There's pressurized chemicals and dangerous things that, you know, could really harm people in space, right? There could be a big accident. We don't want that. So, you know, commercial LEO destinations, commercial space stations, really important for human exploration and that stepping stone to the moon. But there's companies like Rogue Space, a real close partner of Space Phoenix's. They're building unmanned platforms. They're building, think of them as industrial parks in space, right? They're the infrastructure, the power, the cooling, and all of that. And then Space Phoenix is going to deliver products and get products, right? We're going to have this logistical infrastructure that we're so used to having on Earth, right? But that same logistical infrastructure, we're going to need it for the the commercial space stations, and we're going to need it for the moon, and eventually we're going to need it for Mars.
What kind of timeline? When you talk of a commercial space station, is this a 5-year thing? Is this a 10-year thing? Is this 20 years?
No, man. I tell you, Vast, a company out of I believe they're in Long Beach, California, really well funded. They're putting up Haven 1. I believe next year, early 2027, that module will hold 4 people on orbit. I mean, in the most modern space station with artificial gravity, a centripetal force induced artificial gravity, great for humans, but not great for manufacturing. Right? Because in the end, we're going to space to manufacture to get rid of gravity.
But I assume this is like a modular station,
yeah,
so you can add
all
components. Okay.
That first one is not so modular. Their next one, Haven 2, is definitely much more modular.
Okay.
Axiom is taking a little different strategy with modules. Starlab is taking a very international approach, so definitely modular. And they will be, right? We're going to grow. And so NASA's putting a lot of money into this. The U.S. government's putting a lot of money into this. But globally, governments are putting a lot of money into this because we know this is it. Like we've got to do this, and we've got to do it for very esoteric reasons, for all mankind. But we got to do it for very pragmatic reasons. Of the next biotech comes from space. The next industrial. I gave a talk on this. Mark Anthony Thomas from the GBC was there. He was one of my panelists 2.5 years ago. I gave a talk on the next industrial revolution. The next industrial revolution happens in space, right? I don't know if it's the fifth or the fourth or the sixth. I don't know. But the next one is happening. It's happening now.
Sometimes I think it's important to consider this as a convergence of a lot of the ways that this is all coming together. Artificial intelligence, yes, but also manufacturing and robotics in a huge way are laying the groundwork for us to build these automated facilities that can exist in space. Right? Most of SpaceX and a lot of these spaceships are automated, right? A pilot's not necessarily flying. The delivery missions that are happening to ISS, the International Space Station today, they're generally automated flights, which it's crazy to think of, that we can send something without a human on it to space, have it deliver, whatever it is that is being delivered, do a supply mission, come back and land. But this is that convergence of all these things, right? It's getting to the point that we can manufacture CPUs here on Earth using entirely automated processes, and that we can take those processes that are using robots, using artificial intelligence, using the technology we have today, and we can place that in space and then take advantage of those benefits of building something that's nearly flawless because of microgravity.
Yeah, Jason, the convergence of the different technologies is amazing. If you're a real space nerd, you know rendezvous and docking in space. This 6 degrees of freedom problem. I mean, it was probably one of the single toughest things that they did on the Apollo program, right?
Yeah.
You got the command module orbiting the moon, and then the lander goes down, and then part of the ascent module comes up, and then they got a rendezvous. The fact that they did it successfully every single time is amazing. Rendezvous has become almost like mundane. With all the new technologies and the computing power and the AI, the Cygnus has never missed. It's perfect every time. Now, I probably just jinxed the entire space program. but yeah, it is really weird. And then manufacturing, we're gonna get this world of automated manufacturing and AI. It's gonna be AI enabled, hardware focused, but AI enabled, right?
So. One last question.
Please.
So at the top, I said that space, it feels impossible. It feels like something that's fantasy, right? Out of a book, a movie, a TV show. So I'm curious, for people who are listening, what would you say is the clearest proof of the things that we've talked about or the things that you see happening, that this is no longer fantasy, that there's a sign that this space economy is here, it's real, it's tangible to the everyday person?
Wow. All right, Jason, you might have stumped me. I think one of the coolest things that the average person can do, I'll say the average semi-space interested person can do. One of the coolest things is to get on NASA's website, or you know, if you're not a big fan of NASA, get on another website that tracks the ISS, and wait for it to fly overhead on a clear night. Blow your mind what you can see. Get a pair of binoculars, you can see the whole shooting match. Get a good telescope. It's mesmerizing for the average person, and the average person doesn't know that you can see the ISS with the naked eye right here in Baltimore on my street.
You said closer than New York.
Closer than New York by a long shot, and with nothing in the way. So I think that's one of the things that just kind of wrap your arms around it. I think the next thing is just to stop and realize like how much of what we have and do. The weather report, heck, international traffic, ships at the very least, all being tracked via satellites. So it's ingrained into our life, whether we know it or not. What's going to happen tomorrow and in the years to come is the products we're going to see, the problems here on Earth that we're going to solve. Man.
Thank you, Andrew. You can learn more about Andrew and his business, Space Phoenix, space-phoenix.com, and also make sure you follow him on LinkedIn. Thank you. I appreciate you coming in and spending some time educating us on everything that's happening in space.
No doubt, Jason. Great conversation.
And before we go, John Gruber over at the blog During Fireball posted a link that I fell in love with. It's a video of two AI chatbots stuck in an infinite loop of business pleasantries. Here's a few seconds of the loop.
Thank you for letting me know. Let's keep things as comfortable as possible for you.
Of course. And honestly, no frustration here at all. I'm just glad we can shape the vibe so it feels right for you. So we'll keep it fun, light, and super comfy. Just let the whimsy flow.
Absolutely. That sounds perfect. I'm all in for making it a great experience. And
AI is amazing and will change the world, but things like this are great reminders of how much it takes to create real intelligence and how far away we really are. So, all right, that's it. This is Thoughts on Tech and Things, and that's it for this week. All the links are in the show notes, including the link to my biweekly newsletter. If you've got thoughts on today's shows, questions, or ideas for future episodes, you can click the microphone to leave us a message in the WYPR app, or go to www.jasonandperry.com. New episodes drop every other Wednesday, and we've got some exciting conversations lined up. Thanks to the team at WYPR, our producer, Sam Burmese-Dawes, and Perry Labs Head of Operations and Marketing, Myrna Martinez. I'm Jason Michael Perry. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next time.